Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
Every morning he wakes at 4:30, and every morning I wonder how he does it. It's April, and I hear the familiar sounds of the zipping of the fleece jacket and the whir of the kettle boiling. Not for the luxury of a coffee, but to thaw the frozen dew from the Jeep window. The dog, long attuned to this routine, rises from her slumber and dances around his feet as he pulls his wellies on and steps out into the morning chill. Lambing season is here. Lambing season sounds delightful, doesn't it? Green pastures speckled with fuzzy newborn lambs prancing about on wobbly legs. Spring, the season of new life and nature at its most bountiful. Well, that's not the full story. Lambing, for a farmer, means late nights in bitterly cold sheds, coaxing stubborn ewes into motherhood, rubbing warmth into quivering creatures. It's evening calls to the man who has the cure for the farmyard pox known as ORF, or summoning neighbours for help with a birthing crisis. It's a brutal combination of sleep deprivation, sodden clothing, fleeting victories, and fated losses. And yet, some people just take to it. My partner is one of those people. He's not sentimental about it. He doesn't gush over his lambs or give them names. He doesn't pretend this is anything but business. Still though, when I see him tending to a newborn lamb who has arrived weak and limp, I notice his air of determination that says, defeat is not an option. He'll mutter profanity at it, which I imagine is some kind of motivational technique. Then, with luck, the lamb's drooping body will pulse and it'll kick out. He'll place it tenderly under the glow of the heat lamp and wait to make sure the mother accepts it. Then move on without any more fuss. Barely even a look of satisfaction on his face. Just another job done. I recognise this calibre of man. Years ago, on a different farm in Wexford, there was another man who moved through life in much the same way, without a need for fanfare, my father. He was a dairy farmer, and I remember the subtle strength of a man who rarely exhibited joy, who seemed at his most relaxed amidst hardship. Only now, watching my partner, can I begin to understand the appeal of this farming life. Sitting still is not natural for these men. The idle pleasures that most of us enjoy, a lie-in, a holiday, are wasted on them. Their peace is found in routine and work. The harder, the better. Lambing happens in all weather, and in Ireland, that usually means the worst weather. Fields transform to sludge, winds batter shed doors, and the occasional bit of snow can arrive in time to make a testing task that bit more testing. Yet these farmers don't complain. I am in awe of their resilience. This is a kind of stoicism of character that goes back centuries. Maybe you could call it mindfulness. Finding calm, thriving even, in work that is repetitive, physical and unyielding. My partner may not talk much about his emotions, but he works them out through aching muscles and calloused hands. Through the steady rhythm of feeding lambs and surveying their mothers. The worries and troubles of life are all poured into the labour. Of course, the work also takes its toll. Lambing can break a person in small ways or big, from complete exhaustion to being overwhelmed by the burden of too much loss. Though many lambs will flourish, others will slip away. Too weak to survive, and all those hours of effort amount to nothing. No time to be down about it, he surrenders with a frown, toots, wipes his hands onto the next one. And thus, for 6 weeks, he functions on minimal sleep, pulls on the same frayed jumper and the same batter coat, and eats whatever is handed to him in whatever few moments he can steal. Sometimes I think I should worry about him. But then I see him, stressed out, dog tired, but totally himself. Not happy, exactly. Happiness and farming don't seem to go hand in hand. But fulfilled. And I suppose that's enough.
In 1996, I went to Beirut for a fortnight to visit my sister. It was September, the pines in the hills crispy after a long summer, the beach clubs along the coast still open. We ate meze and sticky barbecued meat on the terrace of an Ottoman palace in the Shouf Mountains, where the only other diners were Druze leader Walid Jumblat and several hundred Syrian Boy Scouts. We sat by the altar in the Temple of Bacchus at Baalbek, waiting for the sonic booms of Israeli jets and Hezbollah anti-aircraft fire to end so the guide could resume our tour. We went to Damascus on a coach. We didn't realise until we were standing in front of a stone step that was weeping the tears of Christ that we were on the Maronite Christian equivalent of a day trip to Knock. Lebanon was broken and chaotic and achingly beautiful, and I didn't want to go home. I stayed for 2 years. I found a job. There were lots of people like me in Beirut in those days, brought there by the opportunities offered by the rebuilding of the city after years of war. At the weekends, we met in English-style taverns and Irish pubs and compared notes on the insane driving and the parasitic infections our delicate stomachs were prey to. We complained, but really we loved the place. There were other workers, men from Syria and India who waited on street corners at dawn, hoping to be picked for a day's labouring on one of the thousands of construction sites. An army of women in pink gingham housecoats, women from Sri Lanka and the Philippines and Africa who were employed as domestic servants. From early morning, you could see them on apartment balconies, hanging out washing, wiping dust from French doors, squeezing out mops. It still shames me that we were called expats while they were referred to as migrant workers. At Christmas, I stayed in Lebanon as I could only get one day off, the 25th. This was more than compensated for when it came to Easter, of which there were three: Roman Catholic, Maronite, and Greek Orthodox. The butcher on the corner put live chicks dyed in the pastel shades of sugared almonds in a cage outside his shop, and for three Sundays in a row, bells rang out across the hills. I came home to Ireland the following year, promising myself I'd go back one day. It took nearly 20 years. When we got off the plane, the air was warm and mildly fetid, and my sister and her husband were waiting. I felt as though I'd never left. We found ourselves in a convoy of rusty, overcrowded buses that were driving two abreast and overtaking on hairpin bends above sheer valleys. They were packed with women and girls who had their arms thrust out the windows, beating out a rhythm on the roofs and singing at the top of their voices. One of the buses hit a car, and when the police came, they ordered the passengers out. The girl stood at the side of the road in long white robes, a black cross marked on their foreheads like Catholics on Ash Wednesday. They were celebrating Mescal, the Ethiopian festival that commemorates the finding of the true cross. Ethiopian Christians believe that Helena, the Roman queen, had a revelation in a dream. She was told to make a huge fire and that its smoke would show her where the true cross was buried. The people of Jerusalem brought wood and made a vast bonfire. They doused it in frankincense and set it alight. The smoke rose high in the sky, settling on the ground precisely where the cross had been buried. The Mescal national holiday had been a couple of days earlier in Ethiopia, and the women had waited until Sunday, their only day off, to have their own celebration in the mountains above Beirut, which were dotted with Christian shrines in dusty glass cases. We had a long lunch in a garden overlooking vineyards and olive groves, and when we left, the roads were quieter. Later that evening, we saw one of the girls. She was standing by herself in the centre of Place Sassine, a busy roundabout in the city, cars and taxis spinning around her. She hoisted her white robe an inch and dashed through the traffic amidst angry shouts and the honking of horns. Back to an apartment balcony and a pink gingham housecoat. The white robe folded away until next year.
The less said about Samuel Beckett, the better. I mean this as the highest compliment. A writer who pared down words to their essence, who mined the dark treasures found in silence, and who wrote a stage work lasting 35 seconds, would not have appreciated garrulous elegies. To the many thousands of words written about him since his death in 1989, he would have listened with a wry smile, but surely without a response. In college, we revered him. This was the Irishman who had written the most famous play of our time, Waiting for Godot, in a copybook from the front to the back, and then turning the copybook around from the back to the front. And he had written this existential masterpiece in French. His picture looked down eagle-like from the wall of our flat in Dublin, alongside that of Che Guevara. Sam Beckett was born on this day in 1906. At our age, he had been an accomplished cricketer, playing with distinction for Trinity. He was also good at tennis and, allegedly, bar billiards. He moved to Paris to teach English in the late 1920s, where he became Joyce's friend and amanuensis. But when he turned away from the advances of Lucia, Joyce's daughter, the friendship between the two men cooled. In 1938, in Paris, coming home one night from the cinema, Beckett was stabbed in the chest by a pimp and nearly died. He subsequently met his attacker in court and asked him why he had stabbed him. "I don't know, sir. I'm sorry," the man replied. Beckett was so struck by the randomness of the pimp's response, which seemed to encapsulate his own view of the absurdity of human existence, that he declined to press charges. During the Second World War, he fought with valour in the French resistance, for which he was awarded the Croix de Guerre, but later dismissed his time in action as Boy Scout stuff. He seldom gave interviews and shunned the limelight. His inaccessibility was part of his legend. And so it was one late spring afternoon in the 1980s, I was sitting in a cafe in Paris, up behind the Sorbonne, killing time before I met a friend, when I looked out and, as a thud hit my chest, saw him coming up the street. There was no doubt. The tall, slim frame, the stooped gait, the spiky hair, the chiselled features, the face that had looked down at us from the wall in our flat in Dublin. Our hero. And now here he was, almost level with where I sat. The next thing I knew, I had fallen into step beside him and we proceeded up the pavement together. Breathless with awe, not quite sure of what I was doing, but giddy with excitement, I conveyed my admiration. Beckett inclined his head of famously close-cut grey hair in patient but gracious acknowledgement. Having read somewhere that he followed the activities of the Irish rugby team, I launched into an uninvited analysis of the then dire state of Irish rugby. He looked at me imperiously and then nodded, which I took as a sign that he agreed with my conclusions. We halted for a traffic light. He was taller than me by an inch. He was wearing a jacket of black and white herringbone tweed and a scarf. The light went green, we crossed together, step for step, and I, starstruck, gabbled on about God knows what until the next light loomed. It was then I took out paper and pen and asked for his autograph. Pickett drew up and peered at me. Oh, Christ, I thought, I've done it now. But no, he took the paper and pen and, doubling the paper, very slowly wrote his name. Thank you very much, Mr. Beckett, I said, and added, lovely day, isn't it? He smiled. Lovely, he said, and walked on. I was thinking of him recently when I read that a cryptocurrency billionaire, someone who has made his money from trading in something that doesn't actually exist, had paid more than $6 million at an art auction for a banana taped to a wall. The purchaser later ate the banana. I don't think Sam Beckett would have been in the least surprised. He presented us with the basic absurdity of the human condition and, in his sparing words, made us acknowledge with a graveyard smile that he was merely telling us what we already know.
I was 13 when I first encountered Lucy. I suspected she was of similar age, but she seemed much more mature. Ours was a slightly strained relationship. We tiptoed about each other, shrouded in an atmosphere of great suspicion. Our choreography was, to say the least, cautious. It was summertime and I had been given my first responsible job. The position came with its own transport and involved travel. Lucy, you see, was the donkey used to haul a cartload of milk churns to the creamery. Our journey couldn't begin until I first caught the ass where she grazed in her paddock. She had an ability to ignore any unwanted visitors to our realm with all the skill of a tired barman at closing time. I discovered that the sound of a handful of oats being rattled in an enamel basin might sometimes catch her attention. Once the winkers were over her head, the pantomime of harnessing could commence. Lucy could make the process very awkward. With hames and collar, straddle and belly band in place, we could proceed to the next stage. The task of reversing her between the shafts of the cart offered a showcase for her real stubborn streak. When I needed to move her in one direction, she twisted the opposite way, making sure that she trod on my feet during the process. I sometimes caught my mother watching the proceedings from the farmhouse window, and I couldn't but notice the grin on her face. Eventually, we got started on our 3-mile journey to the creamery. Pace was dictated by Lucy. No amount of encouragement could alter her sway-backed amble. I needed to keep constant connection with her via the reins. Whenever she thought my concentration had wandered, she merely stopped to munch on the nice things she noticed growing in the long acre beside the roadway. She seemed to have a preference for chickweed, vetch and Queen Anne's lace. The roadway was tarred. On hot days, the tar would blister and pop like bubblegum beneath the iron bands of the wheels. It was a slow and noisy odyssey. Over time, I found it was useless to urge Lucy away from our roadside treats. She made it clear that she had never agreed to this undertaking in the first place, and this was her way of reclaiming dignity and ownership. There were 3 filled milk churns in the cart. On the journey to the creamery, I was conscious of a sloshing noise emanating from the cans. It seemed to have a soporific quality that lent itself to daydreaming. And believe me, Lucy took full advantage of any lack of attention thus induced. On the morning of my first working day, we joined the snaking procession of carts and tractors outside the creamery. I watched the procedure and the protocol involved. The cart needed to be reversed up to the loading bay and the lids removed from the churns so that they might be manhandled by the creamery staff. Lucy refused to cooperate. She moved in every direction other than reverse. Then, when I finally had the cart in situ, I discovered I did not have the strength to remove the big churn lids. The action of the sloshing milk had created a form of vacuum and welded them stuck. With red-faced embarrassment, I finally called for help from the smirking strongmen. Lucy picked that moment to bellow out a hee-haw that some might construe as laughter. It's a humiliation that is still almost too painful to recall. Our journey home with three now empty churns was a slightly different affair. Lucy possessed a homing instinct that would put any sat-nav software to shame. The minute we turned for home, she set off at an exhilarating gallop. We rattled and rolled. Lucy pulled back her ears, leaving a brief trail of dust in our wake. But you know the saying, and I can verify that it's true, short and sweet like an ass's gallop. That initial burst of speed was all the donkey wished to deliver. Within a few minutes, it was back to roadside grazing for her and more daydreaming for me. I was beginning to understand how the summer with Lucy was shaping up. I thought about her in recent times. On television news bulletins, there are frequent images from the Middle East showing stoic donkeys carrying bewildering loads of bewildered people through bewildering landscapes. There's no vetch or chickweed or Queen Anne's lace, no verdant pasture, but still the donkeys plod on. However, their role was not always so ignominious. On a glorious occasion, one of their kind carried a man in triumph through the streets of Jerusalem. Palm fronds were tossed beneath the donkey's hooves to soften its journey. Because of who they carried, it is said that each ass wears a branded cross on its back by way of reward. It took me a long time to realise Lucy knew something I was unaware of, and that at the end of the day, she was a lot cleverer than me.
Take me back to my boots and saddle.
On a windy spring day, I stand on a rocky shore with my back to Galway Bay, staring at a low sandy cliff. Halfway up, there's an irregular line of holes which I'm attempting to count. 30, 35, maybe 40 in all. All summer long, the sky here is alive with chittering, dancing birds, looping and twisting and spiralling. For the holes are the nests of sand martins, the small brown and white cousins of swallows. Each pair of martins digs out a burrow close to their neighbours and lays a clutch of eggs inside. Once the chicks have hatched, the parent birds dart continuously in and out, catching gnats and flies to feed to their hungry brood. After a few weeks, the fledglings are strong enough to stretch their young wings and launch themselves into the air from their high homes, learning to fend for themselves. Today, the cliff is quiet and empty. There's not enough food to sustain the birds over an Irish winter. So last September, they set off on their long journey south, flying over France and Spain, across the Mediterranean and the Sahara, to the lands of West and Central Africa. And there they stay, feeding but not nesting, until they feel the call to fly all the way north again, arriving back at the same beach they left months ago. It's an annual round trip of about 12,000 miles, yet a sand martin is small enough to fit in the palm of your hand. For centuries, people wondered where birds like swallows and martins disappeared to in winter. The Greek philosopher Aristotle suggested that they hibernated in trees or in crevices in rocks. In the 16th century, a Swedish priest concluded that swallows spent the winter in the mud at the bottom of lakes. It's likely he came to this conclusion after watching the birds swooping low over the water, fattening up on insects shortly before they vanished at the end of summer. A few decades later, an English minister and naturalist called Charles Morton hypothesized that the birds flew to the moon, estimating that this would take them 60 days. It wasn't until something strange happened in rural Germany in the 19th century that people began to understand the real story of bird migration. Every spring, pairs of handsome white storks returned to the village of Klutz to build their large twiggy nests on tall trees in the church tower. In 1822, the villagers noticed a very odd bird. It had something lodged in its body that looked like a long, thin stick. The lower end protruded below its shoulder. The centre part was hidden inside the bird's neck, and the top extended up beyond its head. It's not on record how the stork died, but when it was examined, the locals realised the object was a beautifully crafted wooden arrow with a small triangular tip. No local people hunted with bows and arrows, so where did it come from? Eventually, someone identified the wood of the shaft. It was from an African tree. A hunter in a far-off country had shot the bird, which had not only miraculously survived, but had been strong enough to obey its migratory instinct and fly all the way to Germany with an arrow through its neck. It was named the Pfeilstork, the arrow stork, and was stuffed and put on display at the University of Rostock as the first substantial evidence that birds migrated over long distances. Understanding of these extraordinary journeys gradually expanded, helped by better telescopes and developments such as bird ringing, invented by a teacher in Denmark at the turn of the 20th century. Today, the science of seasonal migration is global, digital, and highly sophisticated. Researchers attach tiny GPS transmitters to birds' wings and monitor them with satellites. Radar networks track migratory movements, and citizen scientists around the world upload their observations into international databases. Yet it still feels miraculous that swallows and martins, corncrakes and cuckoos, and so many other birds have evolved to make such astonishing annual trips. And it's with a sense of excited anticipation that I return to the rocky shore every late spring, scanning the cliff and the sky for the returning sand martins, until I can call out happily, "They're back."
Same swallow swooping sooner brings the season, sooner brings the season of when on white blossom.
Scullion, or Song of the Blackbird. This is Grandmother's story, or at least some of it. Nora's story, the latter part of a long life and towards the end. Knowing her and loving her for her gentle kindliness has left deep feelings of loss and a sense of how committed to this world an old woman of her generation might have been. To be in the flesh means, at times, to be in darkness. To be on her knees, for instance, as I often noticed her, searching in the cupboard under the sink for a rag or a feather duster, being scullion. Once she found a large grey rat, mad alive, trapped in the wire cage she had baited with cheese. She screeched and shoved it with her foot, cage and all, in under the base of the dust-dark pantry tall boy. In the privy, out in the corner field, a hole in the galvanized admitted a pencil of light that drew a line across the right-hand wall. She kept neat squares cut from newspapers, and sometimes, in almost understairs darkness in that space, she read reports of wars and murders. To her, the notion of incarnation was a difficult way of being, and who would ask for it? Then, when she knelt in prayer, touching the thou of him, touching the thou of her, she pitied the one whose hands and feet had been broken with old iron nails. When all the universe, that dreadful day, fell still under the blanket of ultimate darkness, she knew his suffering and heard his cry of forsakenness. Such things moved me about this hard-working woman, such things touching on life and the source of life, like the kneading of dough for currant buns, the buttermilk's assuaging bitterness and the churning of butter in the scullery. I have known my God, she said to me, by the works of the everyday, lone and prayerful in the kitchen. Times, she said, before the heart-softening advent of spring, your grandad would drop the rag-doll limpfall of the goose onto the scullery boards, peppered by his shotgun, way out on the wetlands and plump after her wintering stay. The wild bird, she said. I saw her innocent in her fiery orange beak and pitiful pink legs, the timber of the old deal table looking suddenly nude beneath the still warm presence, death-sodden. And I handled her, she said, with a kind of love. Broke off the wings for feather dusters, chopped off bone head and leathery legs to honour her in her baptism of fire. Bloodstains and feathers stayed clinging to my fingers as I plucked and cleaned, immodest to be rooting through her innards, and I begged forgiveness, knowing the wonder, she said, of the age-long goose flight, nights and days through freezing skies, effortful, mysterious, worthy, only to be flopped down on this scoured deal in the nakedness of guts and viscera. Till I found myself, oh, foolish, she said, weeping for the grey lag, for myself, for the slaughtering. When Grandad died, I felt the more for her. The wearing of black after a death lays too much weight on the spirit. It is to walk an endless seeming road in the dark night, to misconstrue the twittering of the lesser birds and lose the morning message of the cockerel crowing from his perch. God, we are told, is God of the living, and life in its plenitude is a revelling in the light. Nora's love for Ted, Ted's love for Nora, had been a difficult duet, bass contralto. So, when she took to wearing black, there was a residue that held, in sadness, an earnest of eternal love. She stood watching out over the waves of the Atlantic as they broke insistently on the strand, but she no longer heard the music. He who had known her was no more part of it, and now she could scarcely tell herself who she really was. She took a sip of brandy against the frost and found that being alone with her God brought hurt and a sorrow she could not overcome. At dusk, the blackbird, high in the foliage of the cypress tree, sings instinctive songs of love to the failing light. The pathways to the stillness that is beyond our countless experiences are many. When darkness falls and the blackbird sings no more, she wonders, too, if another dawn might ever break.
On this morning's programme, we heard Lambing Season by Kate O'Shaughnessy, Mescal in Lebanon by Louise Kennedy, A Single Word was by Peter Cunningham, Travels with Lucy by Joe Carney, The Arrow Stork by Jenny Beale, and Scullion or Song of the Blackbird was by John F. Dean. The music was The Frost Is All Over by The Chieftains featuring The Punch Brothers, East of Any Place by Roger Fache, Chopin's Prelude No. 6 in B minor, played by Mao Fujita, Take Me Back to My Boots and Saddle by Bing Crosby, and Same Swallows Swooping by Zoe Basha. And Zoe is going to be playing various dates around the country from next week, starting with the launch of her new album in the Sugar Club in Dublin next Thursday. Her website, zoebasha.net, has more details. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.